Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with Peter Burke.
Hello once again and welcome to Farming Aotearoa, our monthly look at what's been happening and what might happen in the wide agricultural sector, which of course includes horticulture. With me in studio is farming journalist Peter Burke. There's quite a lot happening, Pete, by the sounds of things. You're looking quite busy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm busy because I've also got other social things on my mind as well, so it's not entirely work, but it is a busy time, and I think we're going through a period in agriculture where there is a lot happening with a new government coming in. They've got changes, so we're seeing a reset of the country in terms of the farming community. Farmers are looking to the government to say, will you change things that you promised you would do? So there's all this thinking of, are the promises going to be delivered? If they are, how will they materialise? And at the same time, nice to make promises locally, but we still live in a global economy, a global world. What's happening in the Middle East is just as relevant as to what's happening on the farm in New Zealand. So we're going to talk through those today. But okay. I think what I'd probably like to start off today is look at something that's very dear to my heart, and that's the issue around Māori farming. That seems to be a topic that's we're going to get into in the next month or so, particularly for me anyway.
Okay.
So we had a few weeks ago, we had the announcement of the finalists in this year's Ahu Whenua Trophy competition, and two finalists were selected for that. That announcement was made at Parliament. We had about 100 people along there. We had all the ministers. We had Minister Potaka, Minister McClay and other MPs there, diplomats, representatives of the Irish and British High Commissions and others. A very big day for the finalists themselves and their whānau, the wider whānau, and also all the agribusiness leaders. So we've got two great farms. I know one of them, and that's Wairarapa Moana. Now, that's interesting. They're up in Mangakino, up in the central North Island, a very, very big operation. They've got something like 10,000, 12,000 cows. It's huge. It's
wow.
A massive operation. Interesting, the history of that, though, I think, probably, is that they were, as the name suggests, Wairarapa. They were actually originally from the Wairarapa. When the settlers arrived, they sort of, by coercion and other means, unfair means, kicked them out of there, basically. And in the end, Wairarapa Wana settled reluctantly for the land up in Mangakino, which is not as good as they had in Wairarapa, let's be fair about it. I think people say disadvantaged Maori. The answer is yes, it is. But to their credit, since 1915, the Trust has done a great job, and they've done an amazing work. They've got some very good people there, but now, 12,000 cows, it's a lot. And they're the biggest supplier to a Māori dairy company called Miraka, which is just out of Taupo. And it was Wairarapa Moana, which became the cornerstone of that development of that Māori dairy factory, in conjunction, believe it or not, with a Vietnamese dairy company, Vinamilk. So quite interesting. The whole plant is run on geothermal power, so they've got another trust alongside them that writes to geothermal power. So the Miraka plant is run by geothermal power, believe it or not.
So how long has that been run by geothermal power?
It's been run, I think it's about 12 years, I think. Required. Okay. I remember being there for the opening of it, and just to see it, I saw it being built.
Yeah.
It was quite amazing, but just to think that they do that. And then what they do, the other side of that, is the waste from Miraka goes across to a horticultural operation run by the other trust, growing tomatoes, and they use that for composting.
Ah.
So it's a very sustainable operation up there. So they're quite big. So they've actually just chosen one of their farms for this, which is a smaller one. They've just taken one of their single farms, and that will be, I think it's around about 900 cows. Remember? Yeah, so that's about it. So we'll just be looking at one farm, but not the 10.
Right.
The other farm that's been chosen is one up in Apotiki, up in the Eastern Bay of Plenty, Whakatea, which is a trust that has a farm just out of Apotiki. It's interesting that they've got a number of iwi put in together to form a large land holding. Well, large by 200 and just over 200 hectares of land. They've got They've got a number of cows there, 700 and just over 700 cows, nearly 800 cows there, and they milk somewhere around, you know, 800, 600 to 700 at peak. So it's a big operation. So in the next few weeks, those farms will be having field days at which members of the public can come along and actually go on the farm and see what they're like. So okay. They've been selected now. They have two judging processes, interestingly enough. The first one is to find finalists, two or three, depending. Those two finalists then have a separate panel that comes along and judges them and determines a winner. So it's they're completely different people. Mm. They see it through a different lens. So that's where that goes. So that's going to be fascinating to see, to go to these. I think Māori are interesting for me anyway, because I get to see parts of the country that the average person would not see in a day. You know, Mangakino is not sort of the place you go for a cup of coffee on the way to Taupo. And the Potiki is somewhere you probably don't want to go to either. But then I'm going to tick down to Gisborne as well and have a look at Tarawhiti on the way home too.
You love travelling around seeing
I know,
places.
I'm just one of these groupie travellers, you know. Anyway.
Okay, what else is going on?
Well, we've got the situation you probably heard in the Middle East where the Houthi rebels are.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a pretty... It's just more than... It's big implications for New Zealand for this in the sense that a lot of our produce to the Northern Hemisphere goes through the Suez Canal, particularly to Europe and that part of the world. That is having an impact, and some of the ships that would normally go through Suez are having to be diverted around the Cape of Good Hope, around the bottom of South Africa. That's another 2 week adding to that journey. Now, that's big in itself, but it's got other problems. It means there's a challenge there because a lot of New Zealand produce goes to certain markets at certain times of the year when there's, say, a festival or an event. Like, for example, in the UK, Easter is a time for lamb sales. So, you know, people buy lamb for Easter, good old poms. They can't get away from our lamb, they love it. So they'll have to arrive at that time to make sure that they cash in on that particular festival. The other problem is then they've got to reroute their ships, work out the schedules. We've done that through COVID. There was a lot of that, as you probably saw there. It's not as bad as COVID, by what I'm told. People say, yeah, it's bad, but this is not quite as bad yet. But the other problem is that by doing this extra 2 weeks, containers start to get messed up a bit. So you end up with this potential shortage of containers in the right place at the right time. Mm. And that affects New Zealand particularly because we're very time dependent. We've got windows of opportunity, like, for example, soon the apple sector is going to start sending its apples. Kiwifruit are coming on now. I know the first shipment is of kiwifruit, Ruby Red are away now. Now, a lot of those will be chartered ships, but still, it's because containers will be a problem, and that's where we don't know when it's going to end up. I was talking to someone the other week, and they're saying, well, if it doesn't get any worse, we might get away with it. If it gets bad, it's really a problem. The other side of this, which I find is quite fascinating, is that I discovered the other day that someone said to me that every ship that goes through that Suez Canal pays the Egyptian government $250,000 per vessel,
wow,
per trip.
Okay.
So imagine there's 75 ships go through that canal every day. Now, if they're not going through there, the Egyptian economy is also suffering. So that's something that we probably, I won't say we don't care about, but it also has another economic effect in other parts of the world. What we're also seeing is that the produce is being dropped off at other places. Some of the ports are already clogged up, and that means some of the stuff has to be cut overland to other places and then shipped onwards. So there is a bit of a mess there at the moment, and it's not helping. The other way around is that we also get stuff from overseas, like we get imports of different things, we get fertilizer in some places, so that's also being affected, and we may see some increase in cost. I don't know. It's a bit of a holding pattern at the moment. It's still bad. How bad it gets, I don't know. And then, of course, you've got the other Ukraine issue and all those things, which they're outside our sphere of, you know, just that they make farming in New Zealand quite challenging because we are the furthest country away from some of our markets, 18,000 k's to Britain and Europe, big markets for us. And the other problem is, of course, the Panama Canal. Now, that's a problem too because they've had a drought in Central America. There's not enough water in the canal at the moment, so the very big ships can't get through there. So that's another issue too. So we're not so badly affected by that one, but certainly the sewers is not something we wish to have. The other thing, just a final point on that, while we are shipping stuff easily to China and places like that because it doesn't go through sewers, the container issue will be a problem potentially because that will spill over into that trade as well. So we've got, it's not only, there's not only the Northern Hemisphere stuff that's affected, It's also what's happening in the Middle East and other places because of that issue of containers, which we've seen, as we saw in COVID-19 particularly, where there was a shambles, basically, global disruption of container traffic. So, yeah, that's all. So I'm not trying to be pessimistic, but that's one of the realities at the moment.
And it's very complicated. You wouldn't think that, you wouldn't even think of the containers really until it makes sense when you talk about it.
Yeah, it does. And yeah. I think it's getting the right container in the right place at the right time. So that's something we've just got to, I think, to be fair, our exporters, our meat producers and others are very, very skilled at that. And we're lucky we've got some very talented people who work incredibly long hours to make sure this happens. So they don't just sit there, counting the sheep outside the window. They do some really good, great work about getting that right, and they do a fantastic job.
Yeah. Okay, what else have you got for us today?
Well, another bit is Todd McClay was up in the Middle East recently to the ministerial meeting on the World Trade Organization, which is something that's very dear to New Zealand's heart. We are great believers in what we call rules-based trade. In other words, we expect that there should be a way that there should be no subsidies. We think that the rest of the world should not do it. The rest of the world thinks we should not be so stupid as to get rid of our subsidies. But that was one of the reasons. But the other part of that meeting was that Todd met up with one of the trade minister from UAE, United Arab Emirates, and they're talking about the preliminary discussions for a free trade agreement with UAE. In dollar terms, it won't mean a huge amount. The tariffs on our products up there at the moment are only about 5%. They're quite low relative to what they were in, say, Europe and in the UK. But it is a good political move, and it's a very, very popular place. We've got a lot of, Dubai, a lot of Kiwis up there. It's one of those sort of hubs, if you like, for the Middle East, a country that New Zealand has very good relationships with, and hopefully that in time there may be this FTA. There's only preliminary discussions. There's now a paper gone out to all those exporters in New Zealand and importers to say, what do you think about this idea? Give us your feedback. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade are doing that. There will be further discussions on Zoom, and then eventually I suspect we'll get down to some nitty-gritty around the table type stuff. One senses it may not be a hard FTA to put together, but then you never know. We've all seen that some things have... We never know what it is, but we export a lot of dairy products up there. We export meat, fruit. A lot of things go into the UAE. So therefore, another one of these nice little things to tick off the boxes. I think that government, the new one in particular, are very keen to prove they can get new FTAs, and this is one that they probably will be able to do a bit easier than perhaps the one with India, which is one everyone wants to do. But India is a completely different case, and I don't think you can compare the two. India's got different issues, like they've got a big dairy industry. They want to buy exports from us, possibly, but it's going to take time to get through there. So this is probably the low-hanging fruit, if you like, of FTAs at the moment.
Yeah,
anyway.
I was going to say, they're cherry-picking at the moment.
Yeah, they are indeed.
Yep. Okay. All right, we're going to talk about the issue of land use change.
Yeah, land use change is a big issue. I mean, we've got it here, even down here in the Horowhenua, as you know. If I look at my own area around the Vin there, you see beautiful, we grow vegetables. We're the vegetable bowl of Wellington, in many cases New Zealand. But there's also pressure for urban development in those areas. Mm. And now, I was talking to someone the other day who said the Vin is starting to become almost a suburb of Wellington now, which is true, that people who have put houses in Wellington are selling up, asset rich, cash poor, buy a house, get some cash, go to the Vin. So there's pressure on urban. So that's an interesting case. It's one that's reflected around the country. We see it in Auckland, around Pukekohe particularly, where, again, there's pressure to have greenfields development, but then you've got highly productive soils. You can put asphalt on it, but you can't grow potatoes in Ashfield.
No,
don't
you cannot.
Quite work so well.
No.
So that's an issue. And then the question is now is, how do you determine what land should be used for urban and what should be kept? And talking to a woman called Robin Dines from Dr. Robin Dines in Ag Research the other week, and she was saying the data on this is not very good at the moment. We need to get more data. And I think one of the issues is there's a bit of a Heath Robinson approach to some of this, that, we've got pressure on developers, let's do this or whatever, whatever. And she's saying, let's get on and sort this out. The other thing she's saying too is that that we need to look at technology as a guide to some of the development we do. Can we manage our existing soils better by using technology? Like we can you can put fertilizer in one part of the paddock and not in another. All that sort of technology is going to come, and I think they took the word precision agriculture, which means simply what it is can you put, you know, a plant in the right place? Can you water that plant and not one next to it? And so on and so on. Can you have greater automation in those areas? Can you be, with GPS, can you be much more precise? And therefore, can you farm much more sustainably? All that sort of stuff. And I think that her idea of technology will be the driver is probably a fair one, actually, because we're dealing with soils. They're sensitive. We've got to get it right. We can't affect to just use it as a conduit to grow things in. So, yeah. We can't make more land. And I feel that valley once upon a time was a market garden. You know, now it's covered in crappy houses, to put it crudely. And you know, Levin is in the same thing. Otaki, I know the same issue. We've seen good productive land there. And one of the problems is that we're getting to a stage now where a lot of those early market gardeners, if you like, and that's what they were called, they're now called commercial growers, but their land is more valuable to sell for development than it is to put into to someone else to buy it.
Yeah.
And you can understand their dilemma, because why shouldn't they get their money back? And why should they sell it for, you know, two-thirds less than what they can sell it to a developer? On the other hand, how do we manage that? And it's a very big issue, I think, in New Zealand, because we don't want to get to the stage where we have to import food, because we know that if we import food, the standards that we have are much higher than most others in the world. That's the fact at the moment.
Yeah, and it would be such a shame if we had to import food into this country. We're more than capable of growing beautiful food.
We are. We are, and I think if you look at our own livestock, they're fed on grass. I mean, if you go to the States, you see beef, it's fed in feedlots. Those animals never see a blade of grass
it's
in life.
It's very cruel.
It is, I agree.
And that terrible way they treat their animals.
Actually, there's a petition out at the moment from John Helstrom. Sidetrack here for a moment, but he's a very well-known vet. He was the head of the National Animal Welfare Advisory Committee. He's setting up a petition right now to persuade the present government to stop its view of allowing live exports. And he says they end up with a ghastly existence once they get there. It's not just the journey; it's also the terrible life they end up. They'll never see a blade of grass again once they leave these shores.
Yeah.
They'll never see it. They'll be in a feedlot. No. I've seen them. I saw Euclid trucks in the States just bringing truckloads of corn to feed. They just...
It's awful. Corn and soy. If people have a big thing about soy. Most of the soy goes to cattle.
It does.
They're all just stuck in horrible places without any... Yeah, it's awful.
Tapioca and the same, and they go up to in the Asia. That's what they feed their cattle on too. Yeah. Just talk a bit more about this land use thing. I think it's really something that we've got to... That people have got to face up to in a whole lot of ways. That there's making money is one thing, but the good thing about Māori, to my perspective, that I really like about, they see their land as something they won't sell. So it goes on from generation to generation to generation. And I'm not saying Pākehā is wrong, but I think they need to look at the Māori view of this, which is to take a long-term view, and that's to say, let's preserve the land. Now, we do see... wonderfully, a lot of farms preserved through generations. They're fantastic. You know, you go along to some farms in different parts of the country where families have been on them for 4 or 5 generations, and that's wonderful. Preserve the land. And I think that's, to me, is a very important thing, that to leave the land in a better state than what you acquired it in the first place. Technology will help us. We can do more. We can do it better. We can do it more sustainably. And I know it's an awful word that I hate it in some ways, but... simply, we can put less damaging things in the soil and still get the same results and better results because our customers want that. And even the other day, in the next story, I'm going to talk about honey, and I'll bring that up again with honey. It's an interesting one too. But people want to know more. New Zealand exports goods to the high-value consumer, the consumer who's discerning, who looks at the product and says, where was that grown and where was that made? How do they treat their animals? What do? They look at those things. They can go on the internet and do that. There is technology that once you've put your phone on a barcode, it will tell you what happened on that land. So all those things are quite important. And we've got to be, farmers cannot distance themselves from what the consumer wants. The consumer is the biggest driver of what we grow, probably. You know, it's not what we can grow, it's what the market wants us to grow.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Okay. So you mentioned honey before.
I know, this is lovely. I remember that. You remember that song, A Taste of Honey?
Yes.
Oh, God, that used to, you know, send all sorts of things down my body. But anyway, the other week there was a launch of the honey strategy, believe it or not, at the Beehive. It seems so ironic, doesn't it? We have bees in the Beehive, but I mean, I thought there were drones there, but we won't go into that one. Anyway, sorry, I shouldn't say that. I'll get hung. But anyway, but one of our local people, Nathan Guy, who happens to be the chair of Apiculture New Zealand, was there launching a strategy from the apiculture sector, along with Todd McClay. And the big thing now is to see the honey industry has gone through a very roller coaster ride. A lot of people came into it and produced honey. And at the moment, the exports went up quite well. Then suddenly the bottom fell out of the market. And to this very day, there are sheds of honey around the country, which is unsold. So that's a problem. We just oversupplied it. The issue then is around Mānuka. And Mānuka is what we see as being New Zealand's honey.
Mm.
God bless the Australians, or maybe God shouldn't bless them.
Come up with another name.
Another name. The underarm mates across the ditch,
yeah,
have claimed that Mānuka was one of theirs, like Farlap was. You know, everyone who was any good was Australian.
Yeah, all that.
Anything. I mean, I find it interesting with Australia. Once upon a time, you had to have a criminal record to get there. Now they're sending their criminals to New Zealand. They're exporting them. They've changed their mind a bit over the years. They've come right, but not in this area. So the issue here is to find a way of doubling exports of honey, particularly Mānuka. And Mānuka, in terms of exports, accounts for 94% of our exports of honey. And that goes to high-end markets again. Like someone said, you know, a jar of honey, a really good honey, Mānuka honey, can fetch even a couple of $1,000 in some places. It's very, very good. It's a health product. So that's a very good thing for New Zealand. It fits in with our whole ethos of saying, like kiwi fruit, for example, is a health food. Yes, it's tasty as well. Apples are good, but it's something that people want to have because it's healthy for them. And that fits in with our whole strategy of going to the discerning market. The consumer that wants to be healthy, wants to know all about honey, fits that bill absolutely perfectly. So the goal of Apiculture New Zealand is to try and double its exports of Mānuka in the next 5 years. And I think by 2030, I think. It's a big ask, and I think even Nathan Guy says that it's an aspirational goal, but it's achievable. It will take a lot of work, but hopefully they will achieve that. It's great to see the honey industry go, because they're so important in New Zealand, not only honey exports, but of course for pollination as well, you know.
Yeah. So, but you know, honey never goes off?
No, it doesn't.
If it's proper, pure honey, never buy it in a jar that you can squeeze. That's not proper. But they've had honey tasting that they've found from thousands of years ago that's still beautiful. And also used in healing, because it seals a cut and gets in and heals the cut, but also seals it from infection getting in.
I love honey.
I'll go and work for the honey department and get rid of this honey problem.
But honey is a great thing. And I think also, I love bees. I think they're such wonderful creatures.
I love them. Yeah.
They're beautiful things. So creatures. I love to see bees and what they do. And these little creatures of God, you know, do so much for us that we don't even recognise. And I think that's the sadness for me in some cases around our farms, that we've taken away a lot of the trees, a lot of the shelter, and that has made it harder for bees to do things. So, I mean, I'm a great supporter of the apiculture industry for a whole lot of reasons, unashamedly so, because of what it does. It's a good one, and it's great to see them getting back on their feet a bit and starting to show that they can do something for New Zealand and maybe get the Mānuka thing going. Māori are very interested in this too. I was talking to Peter Tippany. Some of you may remember him. He's the chairman of the Waitangi Trust. And he was saying that his iwi, Ngāti Hine, they've planted 400 hectares of Mānuka now.
Wow, that's awesome.
What he said was ironic for him was, he said, you know, when I was a kid, my father and I used to get out and cut Mānuka down so we could plant grass to put our dairy cows on it. Oh. Now he said, what are we doing?
Yeah.
We're planting Mānuka now. So Māori are very big on this too, and the Mānuka Charitable Trust, which is involved with the strategy as well, are very much in the game on this one. So they're pushing to support this thing. And I think Māori being behind it is a very good story as well. And I think, you know, top marks to Ngāti Hini for what they're doing and getting manuka. And I think we'll probably see a lot more of that being done in other parts of the country, perhaps back in Te Rāwhiti again, where we did see the problems with the cyclone, where a lot of that land is gone, and maybe we'll see some benefit from that. So manuka, a nice story to end, a taste of honey, a nice way to end this show.
Love it. So what are you going to talk about next time, do you think?
Well, I'll talk a bit about, I suppose next time I will have been up and had a look properly at the farm, so I'll talk about that. So that'll be something I'll have been looking at, and probably just seeing how things go with the government in terms of some of these regulations. We're seeing some progress now. I think we're seeing a little bit more perhaps movement around the dairy side. There's a little bit more news coming up. We'll have some more on, I think, then, as to how China is reacting. Is it going to move up a little bit more? And also, of course, we'll know how the things are going with our apple harvest and our kiwi fruit harvest. They're also in the mix at the moment. So it'll be a bit of a mix next time. But I think look out for what I've got to say about some of these wonderful farms way up in the back blocks of New Zealand, Heartland New Zealand, which I'm looking forward to. I can't wait to get there.
Oh, no, I can see it on your face. I know you'll love it. You'll have a great time. Peter Burke, thank you so much.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.